walls and in windows, so many that Hassan stopped trying to make out the letters. Rich-looking Americans walked fast. Americans who didn't look rich hurried too. Three black men, with muscles ripping at their sweat-stained shirts, were moving a large wooden crate up a stairway into a building. There was shouting and music and engines and radio voices coming from everywhere. A young man rode a two-wheeled motor bicycle, roaring by so fast, almost hitting Hassan and the chief as they crossed a broad street. Hassan had seen a newsreel with policemen on big motored bicycles, but that young man was not a cop. Could anyone ride such a thing in America? They passed a kiosk selling papers, candy, drinks, cigarettes, magazines, combs, pens, and lighters. 2 minutes later, they passed another, selling the same goods. It turned out kiosks were everywhere. A river of moving cars, people, crowded buses, trucks, and even horses pulling wagons flowed along streets that stretched to the edge of sight. The chief walked fast. "In New York, New York, you have to walk like you're late for an important meeting, or thieves mark you." They crossed street after street and rounded many corners. Hassan had draped his blue pinstripe jacket over his arm. He was sweating and dizzy, his head too full of America. The chief stopped at a corner. "Let me see, where are we?" "You don't know?" "I'm just thinking of the best way to go from here." The chief looked around and saw something that made him laugh. "Will you look at that?" Hassan tilted his head and looked, too, up at a window on an upper floor of a building. He saw a flag in the window, posted like a sign, the blue and white flag of Greece, with a cross for the church and the stripes for the sea and sky. A man in shirt sleeves and a loosened tie stood in the window, shouting into a telephone and waving a cigar. "We Greeks are everywhere, no?" The chief laughed again, then held up the palm of his hand. "Look, New York, New York is a simple city to learn. It is shaped like your hand. The numbered avenues are long and run from your fingertips to your wrist. The numbered streets run across the palm. Broadway is the lifeline and curves the length around. The two middle fingers are the Central Park." Hassan studied his own palm. "Now, those signs," the chief pointed to two signs forming an X on a post, "tell us we are at 26th Street and 7th Avenue. That puts us about right here, see?" The chief pointed to the map of his hand. 26th and 7th. Understand?" "Like my hand. Son of a gun." Hassan felt as though he understood. They continued walking up the shaded side of 7th Avenue, then turned a corner. The chief stopped at steps that led into a basement barbershop. "Here's the place," he said, and stepped down to the door. The place was for men only, not unlike barbershops in the old country. Everyone looked over at the chief and Hassan when they came in. A radio was playing, not music, but a man talking and talking over the sounds of a crowd in the background. Sometimes the crowd would roar or applaud. The shelves were lined with bottles of different colored liquids. Cigarettes were smoked, so many that two standing ashtrays were overflowing with butts. The chief spoke English to the older barber. There was another younger barber, the son perhaps, then took a seat off to the side. Hassan sat next to him, listening to the English and looking at the magazines with pictures of crooks with guns and women in tight skirts. Three Americans waited as well, until one of them took a place with the other barber, sitting in a big, comfortable chair made of leather and steel. After a customer paid and said something that made the men all laugh, he walked out the door and up the steps to the street. When another customer was done, he said something funny too, gave the barber some coins, and was gone. The chief took a seat in the big leather barber chair and spoke, pointing to Hassan like he was explaining something. The barber looked at Hassan and said, "You betcha." He draped a white cloth over the chief, pinned it tight behind his neck, then gave the chief a shave. Three times with a hot towel, the lather, and the razor, as close a shave as the Turks give a man in Constantinople. Then he trimmed the chief's hair, shaving around his ears and the back of his neck with a lather and razor. The men laughed and told stories. The chief using so much English, he must be fluent, thought Asan. The Americans laughed and looked at Asan, as if he were in on the jokes. When the chief was clean and smelled of spicy cologne, he paid the barber with paper money, said something in English, and pointed at Asan. The barber said, "You betcha," again, and waved Asan into his chair. As the barber draped his cloth around Asan, the chief spoke in Greek. "A free shave. I paid already. And this is for you." The chief handed Asan a wad of folded paper money. American money. "A smart man like you will do well in America. Good luck." The last Asan saw of the chief was his shoes, climbing the steps back up to the street. Asan walked, feeling his smooth face and smelling the cologne, as the late summer night fell on New York, New York, and the lights took on new warmth. He saw so many amazing things. A window filled with dozens of roasting chickens rotating on mechanical spits. A man selling wind-up toy cars on a box with a wooden rail nailed to the top to keep the toys from rolling off. And a restaurant with one wall all glass, where inside Americans sat at tables and on stools at a long counter. Waitresses swung around carrying platters of complete meals and small dishes of cakes and pastries. Asan passed a long stairway that led down below the street, fenced in with decorated iron and crowded with people going up and others going down, all in a hurry and none of them easy marks for pocket pickers. The building stopped and the sky opened up, and on the other side of a busy street there were thick trees. Asan figured he must be at his middle fingers, at the Central Park. He did not know how to cross the broad street but followed with others when they walked. By a low rounded wall, a man with a cart was selling HOTDOGS, and Asan was suddenly very, very hungry. He pulled out the paper money the chief had given him, finding a bill with a number 1 on it. He handed the money to the man, who kept asking him questions that Asan had no answer for. The only word he could make out was Coca-Cola, the sum total of his English, really. The man handed over a sausage sandwich that was dripping with sauces of red and yellow and stringy wet onions and a bottle of the Coca-Cola. Then the man gave Asan a fistful of coins of 3 different sizes, which he pocketed with his free hand. Asan sat on a bench and ate a most delicious meal. With half the Coca-Cola left, he went back to the man. He held out the coins. The man took one of the thinnest and made another richly burdened sausage sandwich. The sun had gone down and the sky was dark and the lampposts were shining as Asan walked along the paths of the beautiful park, finishing the Coca-Cola. Asan saw fountains and statues. He saw men and women as couples holding hands and laughing. A rich lady walked a tiny dog, the funniest dog Asan had ever seen. He almost howled at it as a joke, but Asan thought maybe the rich lady would complain to a cop, and the last thing he wanted was a cop asking for his papers. At a side entrance to the park, a gate in a wall, Asan came to where the city began again. It was late now, and people were crossing the street, heading into the park, with blankets and pillows. Asan could see these people were not like the rich lady with her dog, but families of white and black and brown people with giggling kids and men and women who looked tired from a day's work. Asan suddenly felt so very tired, too. He followed a family back into the park, coming to a big field of grass, where others were laying out blankets and bedding to sleep outdoors in the hot, humid night. Some were already asleep. Others hushed their kids and made sleeping spots near the trees on the border of the field. Asan found a spot with soft grass. He removed his shoes and used his jacket as a pillow. he fell asleep to the sounds of distant traffic and quiet conversations between husbands and wives. Hassan washed his face in a public restroom in a stone building. Flicking his fingers, he brushed his pants and suit jacket and shook out his nice shirt, then put his clothes back on, wondering where he would walk today. That was when he thought of the man who had been shouting into a telephone, the man who made the chief laugh, the man in the window with a Greek flag. Where was that again? He looked at the palm of his hand, at the map there, and remembered the chief saying, 26th Street and 7th Avenue. And Hassan knew he could find it again. No one was in the window at 26th and 7th when Hassan looked up, but the Greek flag was there. Hassan found an entryway nearby that had a small sign with another small Greek flag on it, and words in Greek, the Hellenic International Society. Hassan went through the door and up the stairs. The day was already hot and the office was sweltering, even with the door ajar and the windows cracked open. Hassan heard music playing, a slow tune, with a voice repeating words, A, space, S, space. A clacking typewriter noise came with each word. D, clack, D, clack, D, clack. At the office door, Hassan saw only a messy desk and some easy chairs. F, clack, F, clack, F, clack, space, thunk. Hassan stepped inside. A girl was in the small inner office, sitting in front of a small green typewriter on a tiny table. She was concentrating on the fingers of her left hand, pressing the keys that matched the instructions on the record. Hassan stayed quiet, not wanting to disturb the typing lesson. Bikanis! Hassan turned. The man who had been yelling into the telephone yesterday was walking in, carrying a small paper bag.
Who are you?
The man asked in Greek.
Hassan Çepik.
Not Greek?
No.
Bulgarian, but I come from Greece. I saw the flag.
The man pulled a cardboard cup filled with what smelled like coffee from the paper bag, along with a round cake with a hole in the middle.
You did not tell me you were coming today, Hassan, or I would have brought you breakfast.
The man laughed out loud.
Dorothy, we need another coffee for Hassan here.
L, space.
I just started a lesson. Pick up the needle. When Bulgarians are hungry, they get nutsy.
The man turned to Hassan.
Dorothy will get you a coffee. At least, that's what they say is coffee here.
Hassan sipped a hot drink, mostly milk and sugar with something of a coffee taste. Dorothy was back at her typewriter, clacking along with the record, U, space, I, space. Dimitri Bacchus, which was the man's name, asked questions of Hassan. Hassan told of his job on the Berengaria and that just yesterday he had left the ship, but said nothing of Ibrahim hiding between the decking or getting off in the city called Philadelphia. Hassan also said nothing of the 4 years since the war ended. Nothing about all his attempts at crossing the border between Bulgaria and Greece. He did not tell of the early morning when his brother made the mistake of starting a fire to heat some water. They were in the mountains, had slept between two rocks, and were planning to move along quickly, but Hassan had some coffee in his pocket. His brother wanted just one cup for energy, he said, but he really wanted the taste of hot coffee on a cold morning. The communist bounty hunters had been trailing after them and saw the smoke from the fire. Hassan had been taking a shit on the other side of a copse of trees. Unseen, he watched his brother put up a fight and a communist shoot him in the head. He didn't tell Dimitri about the man he'd had to kill either. Hassan was drinking from a stream that ran alongside a path when a local man almost stumbled upon him. The man wore a party pin on his threadbare jacket, and the look in his eyes said all Hassan needed to know. The man was running back to whatever village was nearby to report seeing a trader making for the border. But Hassan chased him down, hit him with a rock,
then threw his body down into a gully. Anderson was silent about the time he finally arrived in Athens and made a friend who told him to go to a certain house where refugees like him lived together. When Hassan went to the house, he was beaten up, thrown into an unmarked truck, and taken back across the border into Bulgaria, handcuffed to others who had fallen for the traitor's trick. Hassan said nothing of the communist captain who chained him to a chair, then yelled questions at him, and, not liking the answers, used his fists and then special tools as he yelled the questions again and again. Hassan said nothing of the camp, of the prisoners he saw shot in the camp, of the prisoners he saw hanged in the camp. He said nothing of the girl he met after his release, of their short romance, or of how hungry they always were. He didn't say her name was Nadezhda, or tell of her becoming pregnant, or of their marriage just months before a boy was born, his son, named Petar. He said nothing about his young wife struggling during the birth and the midwife not knowing how to stop the bleeding. Without his mother's milk, the boy lived only a month. Dmitri did not hear of Hassan's son, Petar. Hassan said nothing of his arrest for stealing empty bottles, even though he had not stolen any empty bottles. His name was on a list, so he was again sent to prison. Hassan said nothing of his fourth attempt at escape, his arrest, his year in the work camp, of meeting Ibrahim there, and the night the train came by and separated them from the guards on the other side of the track, and how they threw down their shovels and jumped into the river. He said nothing of the farmer, who found them miles away, wet and freezing, who could have turned them into the party official in the village, but instead gave them hot food as their uniforms dried. He gave them some money, too. 20 levs each. Hassan and Ibrahim bought tickets for the bus to the mountains near the border with Greece. When the police came on board to check papers, they had none. But their prison uniforms happened to be the same as the ones for privates in the army, just with no patches or insignia. When Hassan told the cop that they were reporting to the army hospital because they were carriers of typhus, the cop's eyes went huge at the word typhus, and he nearly ran off the bus. They crossed the border high in the mountains. In Athens, they earned drachmas with picks and shovels, with their hands and their backs, for most of that year, until Hassan got the fireman job on the Despotiko, shoveling coal into the boiler as the ferry made its way between Piraeus and the many Hellenic islands. Hassan said nothing of all that, but only of being a fireman on the Berengaria, with the oil bubble in the tube, and now here he was in America, having jumped ship. Dmitri knew there was much more to Hassan's story, but didn't care. "Do you know what I can do for you out of this office?" "Teach me to type?" Dorothy was now pecking out. "Cap, thunk, Q, clack, space, thunk, cap, thunk, W, clack. Space, thunk." Dmitri laughed loudly. "We have good people who will help us help you. It will take time. But let me tell you right now, if you get into any problem with the law, any problem with the police, everything becomes trouble. Understand?" "Sure, of course." "Okay, now. You are going to learn to speak English. Here is an address of a free school. It meets nights. Just walk in, sign up, and pay attention." Hassan took the address. "You have anything of value you can sell? Anything gold or fancy from the old country?" "Nothing. I left everything on the ship. My old man did the same thing, 1910. Dmitri pulled a cigar from his jacket pocket. "Come back in a few days and we'll have some spare clothes for you. Dorothy, size up Hassan for a couple of pairs of pants. Some shirts, too." "When I'm done!" Dorothy never looked away from her keyboard. "Cap, T, space. Cap, G, space. Thunk, clack, thunk, clack." "You have any lines on a job, Hassan?" Dmitri lit a cigar in a ball of fire that came from a huge match. Hassan had no lines on a job. "Go here. It's downtown. Dmitri wrote something on another piece of paper and handed it to Hassan. Ask for Kostas.
Kostas, okay.
Hassan was leaving the office just as the typing record stopped, and Dorothy turned it over for lesson two. The address was very low on Hassan's palm, down where streets had no numbers and went every which way. He spent most of the day tramping the odd-shaped blocks, going round and round and passing the same points more than once. He finally found the place, a little restaurant, with a sign that said Olympic Grill, surrounded by a Greek key border. There were all of four little tables connected to the wall with leather benches, and eight of the pole stools at a counter. Every seat was taken, and the cafe was hot. A woman was behind the counter, too busy to look at Hassan until he stood in one place a bit too long. She barked at him in Greek. Wait outside for a seat, fool!
I'm here to see Kostas, Hassan said.
What?
The woman shouted.
I'm here to see Kostas, Hassan shouted back. Honey! The woman hollered, turning her back on Hassan. Some fool is asking for you.
Kostas was a short man with a brush for a mustache. He had no time to speak to Hassan, but did anyway.
What do you want?
Are you Kostas? Hassan asked.
What do you want?
A job, Hassan said with a laugh.
Oh, Jesus, Kostas said, turning away.
Dmitri Bacchus sent me to see you.
Who?
Kostas was clearing dishes and taking money from a customer.
Dmitri Bacchus. He told me you would have a job for me.
Kostas stopped what he was doing and looked Hassan in the eye. He was so short, he had to lean back to glare up at the Bulgarian.
Get the fuck out of here!
The customers who spoke Greek looked up from their meals. The ones who only spoke American kept on eating.
And don't come back!
Hassan turned and got the fuck out of there. The walk back to the two middle fingers of the Central Park took a very long time. The air was so hot and thick, Hassan's shirt became wet against his back and didn't dry. He walked and walked along one avenue until bright flashing lights shone down on a place where nine streets seemed to collide in a storm of people, buses, yellow cars, and even soldiers on horses. Or maybe they were cops. Hassan had never been in the middle of so many people with everyone going everywhere. In a huge cafeteria, he spent coins on another sausage, H-O-T-D-O-G, and a paper cup filled with sweet juice, ice cold, as delicious as any drink he'd ever had, even Coca-Cola. He stood as he ate, like most of the people in the place, though he wanted to take off his shoes more than anything in the world. Across the triangle of streets and humanity, he recognized what was a cinema, with a chain of lights chasing each other around and around. Hassan saw the price, 45 cents. That was four of the smallest coins in his pocket, and a larger, thicker coin that had a humped-backed cow printed on one side. Hassan suddenly wanted to sit in a nice seat, take off his shoes, and see a movie. He hoped it would be about Chicago. The cinema was like a cathedral, with uniformed men and women directing a stream of people to seats, chattering couples, and young men in groups, everyone talking loud and barking in laughter. The columns were like those in the Parthenon in Athens. Modern angels were etched in gold on the wall, and a deep red curtain stood 30 meters tall. Hassan took off his shoes just as the curtain opened and a short movie appeared on a screen as big as the hull of the Berengaria. Music played as fancy words flipped and spun on the screen, appearing and disappearing so fast Hassan couldn't sound out a single letter. The movie showed ladies dancing and men arguing. Then another short movie played, with more music and flying words. This movie had boxers in it and skies full of airplanes. A third short movie showed a very serious woman saying very serious things, then weeping, then running down a street calling out a name. Then that movie was over. A moment later, the screen burst into vivid colors as a funny-looking man dressed like a cowboy, but not a real cowboy, and a gorgeous woman with black hair and the reddest of lips
sang songs, and said things that made the cathedral echo with laughter. Despite that, Hassan soon fell asleep hard and deep. The next day there was no one at the Hellenic Society. The whole city seemed quiet, with fewer people coming up out of the stairways that led to tunnels and many of the buildings empty. Hassan found the address for the English lessons, a building on 43rd Street, but there was no one around the place to speak English with. When Hassan returned to the park, though, it seemed like all the buildings surrounding the two middle fingers had emptied into the trees, the paths, the playgrounds, and the broad green fields. Kids and families were everywhere, in a zoo, in rowboats, sliding around on shoes with wheels attached, at a concert of music, with dogs playing, and kids throwing, catching, and kicking all kinds of balls. Hassan liked the dogs the most, and watched them for the longest time. When clouds darkened the sky late in the afternoon, the families packed up, the games of ball stopped, and the park emptied. Rain came soon after, so Hassan found a covered archway and ended up spending the night there, sharing the spot with a few other men who slept on boxes and covered themselves with only their jackets. None of them spoke any of the languages Hassan knew. None of the others seemed happy at all, but Hassan had been stuck in the rain before, and was not at all miserable. He had hidden under bridges, been in wet clothes, walked for days, even run from men in the old country who had the same faces of misery as these guys. This was nothing. In the morning, Hassan woke with a cough in his throat. "These pants should fit you." Dorothy was speaking in Greek. "The boots, too. Try them on in the lavatory in the hall." "What is a lavatory?" Hassan had never heard that word. "The toilet. The men's room." The pants fit well enough. The used boots were not only perfect for his small feet, but were already broken in. Dorothy gave him stockings, a few different shirts, two pairs of heavy pants. All felt good after so many days in his blue pinstripe suit, which Dorothy took from him for cleaning. "What happened to that Bulgarian guy who was here Friday?" Dmitri walked in with a bag of round cakes with holes in the middle and more sweet American coffee. "Hassan, you look like you live in Jersey." Dorothy sat down at her typewriter again and put on another record. Music played in a faster tempo. Cap T-H-E space Q-U-I-C-K space, as Dorothy clattered at the keys. "Did you see Kostas?" Dmitri asked. Hassan sipped his coffee and bit into the round cake, which hurt his throat but tasted good.
"Yeah. He told me to get the fuck out."
Hassan glanced through the door to Dorothy, who luckily did not hear his foul language.
"Ha! Kostas must not have liked the way you looked. But now, you look like a guy from Hoboken, like Sinatra on a weekend."
Hassan had no idea what that meant. "Kostas owes me, so you go back and you tell him I sent you. You did tell him I sent you, right?"
"He didn't care who sent me.
Tell him I sent you." Hassan again walked all the way downtown, arriving at the Olympic Grill when only half its seats were occupied. Kostas sat on the stool farthest away from the door, reading a newspaper with a cup of coffee in front of him, so short he swung his legs back and forth like a little boy. Hassan approached, waiting for Kostas to look up from his paper. But he didn't.
"Dmitri says you will give me a job."
Kostas kept reading. "Huh?" he said, writing a word on an open tablet with a pencil. There were many words on the page.
"Dmitri Bacchus. He sent me to see you."
Kostas didn't move, but managed to change his focus from the newspaper and the list of words to a song.
"What the hell? What is this?" "Dmitri Bacchus said to see you for a job, because you owe him."
Kostas turned back to his reading and writing.
"I owe Dmitri Bacchus shit. Order something or get out of here." "He said to see you for a job."
Kostas was off the stool with fire in his eyes. "Where are you from?" he shouted.
"Bulgaria, but I come from Athens."
"Go back to Athens. I can do nothing for you."
You know where I was when you were jerking off in your shit-filled barn in Bulgaria? I was here. I was in America. And you know what I was doing? Getting my ass kicked for even thinking about this restaurant.
But Dmitri said to go see Kostas, so I came.
He can kiss my ass, and you can go piss in a hat. I feed cops here. They'll crack your head open if I ask. Come back again, and it's the cops for you.
Hassan hurried out of the diner. What else could he do? He didn't want trouble with any cops. The day was as hot as ever. The roar of cars and buses was as loud as a storm wind. The chatter of so many people who all had jobs and money in their pockets and few worries clogged Hassan's ears. His throat was burning and his legs felt like bags of sand. He was heading to 43rd Street in the English lessons, but stopped in a tiny triangular patch of grass and trees as a wave of ache came over him. A new pain in his head knocked and knocked right above his eyes. At a drinking fountain, he cupped his hand to collect enough water to slurp, but the fire in his throat would not go out. He saw two men sharing a bench in the shade, a bench large enough for four, and he wanted to sit down very quickly. Then a violent, invisible punch to his stomach bent him in two, and sickness came out of his insides. A man was asking him questions he could not understand as another led him by the shoulder to the shade of the bench, and someone, a lady maybe, gave him a kerchief to wipe his mouth. Someone handed him a bottle of warm soda water, which Hassan used to rinse and spit out. Someone yelled at him for doing that, but Hassan said nothing. He leaned his head back on the bench and closed his eyes. He thought he slept for a few minutes, but when he opened his eyes, the shadows were longer and different people were in the tiny park. Americans who ignored a napping man on a bench. Hassan reached into his pocket. His American paper money was gone. Some coins remained, that was all. Just as the chief had warned. He stopped moving, and a thief had pocket-picked him. His head ached as he sat for a very long time. As the afternoon became early evening, he didn't want to walk all the way up to the Central Park, but a cop came around and eyed him, so he got moving. An hour or so later, he was asleep under a park tree, his head on his rolled-up pair of extra pants. There were other people in Dmitri's office, all wearing suits and carrying leather cases filled with papers. None of them were Greeks. Dmitri was standing in the window, yelling into the telephone, in English, as he had the first day Hassan saw the place. Two of the men in suits laughed at something Dmitri said. Others lit cigarettes. One man blew smoke rings. Hassan could hear Dorothy typing, clack, 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 without the aid of the record playing music. "Hold on," Dmitri said, seeing Hassan, cupping his hand around the telephone. "Dorothy has your suit. Dorothy!" Every eye in the office looked at Hassan, his rumpled clothes, the growth of his beard, seeing another of the poor, ignorant bastards that were forever showing up in Dmitri's office. Dorothy came out with a suit on a wire hanger. The jacket and pants were crisp and fresh, his shirt folded into a square like a tablecloth. Hassan took his clothes and backed out of the office, nodding his thanks. The eyes and faces of the men in the office had him feeling small, like in the old country, when soldiers searched him, roughed him up, and checked his papers longer than necessary, like when the guards made him stand and answer questions over and over, or like when he and the other prisoners in the camps were lined up for the roll calls that took hours. As he descended the steps to the street, he heard a burst of laughter from the men, and Dorothy taking back up her typing. Clack, 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 clack. As Kostas was counting out a supply of change in the cash register, a man in a clean, blue, pinstripe suit took a stool at the counter. The lunch rush would be picking up soon. The regulars would come and go until after 3 p.m., and Kostas would need to make change for paper money. After that, Kostas would have time to read the paper and find his list of new words. English was not a hard language to learn as long as you studied the newspaper every day
and had a lot of American customers to listen to talk and talk and talk. His wife was wiping down the table, so it was Kostas who asked the man in the clean and pressed blue pinstripe suit, "What can I bring you, pal?" Hassan laid his few coins on the counter, the last of the money in his pocket.
Coffee, please. American coffee, sweet, with milk.
Kostas recognized Hassan and flushed with anger.
You some kind of joker?
I make no jokes.
Dmitri send you back here? Again?
No. I just came for a coffee.
Bullshit, you came for just coffee.
Kostas was so angry, he slammed a mug down so hard in front of the coffee urn he cracked it.
Nico!
He yelled. A boy, as short as Kostas, popped out from the kitchen.
Huh? More coffee mugs!
Nico carried out a tray of heavy mugs for the American coffee. There was no way the boy was not Kostas' son. The only difference between them were 20 years and 10 kilos. Kostas almost tossed the hot coffee into Hassan's lap.
That's a nickel,
he said, taking one of the thick coins off the counter, the one with a humpbacked cow. Hassan poured milk and sugar into the mug and stirred slowly.
You walk into my place and think that because you made it to America, a job is waiting for you.
Kostas was leaning on the counter, so short his eyes were equal with Hassan's.
You go cry to that Corfu bastard and he says, go see Kostas, and I'm supposed to pay you to work for me?
Hassan sipped his coffee.
What the hell is your name?
Hassan.
Hassan. Not even Greek, and here for a job.
Today I'm here for coffee.
Kostas was rocking on his heels, like a man so angry he could leap across the counter and start a fight.
I'm supposed to be so rich. I must have jobs for anyone, eh? Kostas is a big shot. He has his own restaurant. He does so much business, he has jobs coming out of his ass. You can come to America and work for him. Bullshit!
Hassan's mug was almost empty.
Can I have another, please?
No! No more coffee for you!
Kostas stared Hassan in his eyes for a long moment.
Bulgarian, huh?
That's right.
Hassan had finished the coffee, setting the mug on the counter.
Okay, then, Kostas said. Now take off that nice jacket and hang it on a hook in the back. Nico will teach you how to scrub the pots.
Our Town Today with Hank Fassay, your evangelista, Esperanza. Cup of Joe, pal? Addicted to the stuff. Coffee, that is. I'm a newsman, you see, and a newsroom that doesn't run on coffee puts out a lousy paper, I'll bet. The pots here at the Tri-Cities Daily News Herald are filled to the brim, even as most of the staff head out for the ubiquitous high-end spots, the ones with baristas and flavor shots for $6 a throw. A tour of the caffeine parlors in our three conjoined metropolises will prove that good wake-em-up is roasted, brewed, pressure-steamed, and poured in damn fine style. Try Amy's Drive-Thru, a converted taco stand on the Miracle Mile. She'll pop your eyes wide with a triple-bang espresso with a hot pepper stirrer. The Corker and Smythe Coffee Shop in the old Cayley Mercantile Building on Triumph Square just recently offered takeout, and reluctantly at that. Better to sit at the counter and sip that nectar de noir out of those deep porcelain mugs. Café Boss has 3 stores, one at Wadsworth and Sequoia, serving the locals in leather-sleeved mason jars. Whatever you do, don't ask for milk or creamer. They are coffee purists and make a point of telling you why. Java Vavoom, on 2nd Boulevard at North Payne in East Corning, has something no other coffee place can match. A unique sound. There is the whish of the frother, the chitter-chatter of the staff and customers, and music, soft, in the background, like the musical score of a movie playing next door. Occasionally, there is also
the click-clack made by a typist, but in no ordinary sense of the word. Esperanza Cruz Bustamante, born and raised in nearby Orangeville, is an account advisor for a local bank, though to many people, that is her second job. Many folks know her as an evangelista, a typist who uses her words-permitted skills for other people. In Old Mexico, educated nuns serve their flocks by typing important documents, applications, receipts, official papers, tax records, sometimes even love letters, for the illiterate and those who lacked access to the once technological marvel that is a typewriter. Esperanza's parents, like many others, learned touch typing from the evangelistas, then made a living by typing the messages, missives, and memoranda needed by the public. No one got rich, but sentences got stamped into paper. Esperanza has a table at Javavavum, where, with her large drip with soy, she works from a stack of blank, naked pages at the ready beside her typewriter. She's been using the place for a while now. For those unfamiliar with the sound and rhythm of a typewriter in use, Esperanza's clacking took some getting used to. There were complaints at first, Esperanza told me. I'd be typing away and get asked why I wasn't working on a laptop, which is quieter and easier. Once two policemen walked in, and I thought, have they called the cops on me? Turns out they were just coming in for lattes. Why go analog? My email was hacked, Esperanza told me. By who? The Russians? The NSC? Fake Nigerian princes? Who knows? My data was stolen. My life was such a mess for months. These days she uses the internet sparingly and has an old-style flip phone with which she can text, but which she prefers to use the old-style way, by getting and receiving actual telephone calls. She never has to ask for the Wi-Fi password. And as for Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, et al., gave them up, she says, almost bragging. When the hack happened and I went off social media, my day gained like 6 hours. I spent so long checking my phone every few minutes. Never mind how much time I wasted playing snow cone, catching colored balls of ice in a little triangle cup for points. The only negative. My friends had to be taught how to get a hold of me. What is written exactly on that typewriter of hers? Lots. I have a big family. Birthdays, the nieces and nephews get a letter and a $5 or $10 bill. I write memos for work that I either copy or rewrite in an email at the office. And here, she held up a page with the neatest, most perfectly formatted document you could ask for, this is my grocery list. Other customers seek Esperanza for her little nun services. The kids are fascinated by my typewriter. I let them peck out their name as Mom waits for her order. Older ones type out raps and poems. Grown-up seeker services, too. No one has typewriters anymore, none that work. But typewritten letters are special. Some folks come with letters they've composed on a computer they want me to type out for them and make one of a kind. Before Valentine's or Mother's Day, I could sit here for hours and type notes for folks lined up around the block. If I charged, I'd be as rich as a good florist. For such personal service, Esperanza may accept a free coffee, regular in the mornings, decaf in the afternoon. This one fellow was waiting for his coffee and started telling me about an old typewriter he had thrown out. He wished he still had it. He was going to ask his girlfriend to marry him. If he did so in a typed letter, it and the moment would last forever. What could I do but roll in a new sheet and let him dictate? I was his steno of love. We did 6 different drafts. What did he say to pop the question, I asked. None of your business. Did the girlfriend say yes? I had no idea. He read over the letter 12 times to make sure the words fit the occasion. Then he left with it and a vanilla shot cappuccino and has not been seen since. Her portable typewriter allows Esperanza to take her keyboard services anywhere. But Javavavoom is her foe, Plaza Central. This place puts up with me and gets my mind churning. I like having people around, she said. And some of them have come to need me.
Oh, more than you may know, Evangelista Esperanza.
Steve Wong is perfect. Because videos go around the world in nanoseconds, little pigs are celebrated for saving little lambs from drowning. No, wait. That video was an internet hoax. What Steve Wong did was real. It happened. In front of witnesses, even. So he went viral. We went bowling one night, you see. And Steve truly was the alley-ooper who threw or rolled, who bowled, an impossible number of strikes. So he deserves the reverence of all who bowl for fun and profit. Still, if you had not been there to eyeball Steve's run, you might think Anna, M-Dash, and I had faked it all. Steve's accomplishments were not falsified, nor were they a fluke. He'd been the captain of the freshman bowling team at St. Anthony's Country Day High School, winning trophies at young bowler tournaments at the Surfside Lanes. He even had a perfect game, 12 consecutive strikes for a score of 300, when he was only 13 years old. His name was in the paper, and he was given a lot of free swag from the Surfside. When M-Dash hit the year one anniversary of his becoming a U.S. citizen, we celebrated by taking him bowling. We convinced him that it was a great American tradition that immigrants from Vietnam, Chile, et al., went bowling after a year of citizenship and that he should too. He bought it. Steve Wong brought his professional quality glove for his rolling hand, as well as his custom-made bowling shoes. We wore crummy rentals with mismatched laces that were kept in dank cubbies behind the front desk, while he wore one-of-a-kind yellow and brown bowling slippers, Steve and Wong, written across the toes, with three X's on each heel, XXX, representing the final frame of that perfect game of years ago. The shoes came in a matching bag in the same hideous two-tone brown-yellow. We kept rubbing them, hoping to summon a genie as if they were magic lamps. When our beers arrived, I hollered, "My wish came true!" M-Dash had never bowled in his native sub-Saharan village, so we got him his own lane and had the staff pull up the kiddie rails, the things that help little kids keep their balls out of the gutter. With his ball ricocheting from bumper to bumper, he always hit some pins for a high score of 58. My top game was 138. Respectable as hell, what with all the rolling rocks I'd chugged. Anna, bless her, focused so much on her mechanics that she beat my high by six pins, a 144. Flush with the thrill of victory over me, she was giddy, wrapping up M-Dash in her taut-as-coiled-rope arms and calling him our American friend. But the surprise of the night was Steve Wong and his alley prowess. His three games, 236, 243, and a final high of 269, made moot our competitive loop. He was so good we grew fatigued, marveling at the splits he turned into spares. At one point, he rolled 11 straight strikes over two games. I threatened to steal that glove of his and burn it. "Next time I'll bring my own ball," he told us. I couldn't find it. "But you keep those ugly shoes where you can grab them in a jiffy?" We bowled again the next week, the four of us. Steve found his ball with my help. I picked him up from his too-big house in Oxnard and went through the garage and three closets. His bowling ball bag, that lovely yellow and brown leather, was behind an old beat-up plaid typewriter case on the highest shelf in what had been his sister's closet, next to a box that held about 100 old Barbie dolls with vacant smiles and impossibly trim waists. The ball was also that odd color combination, like a sphere of fake puke from a novelty store. The Chinese character for lightning was stamped within the trinity of finger holes. When we got to the Ventura Bowling Complex, he put the ball in a machine that turned out to be a bowling ball polisher,
and he fitted Anna with her own glove, one with a lot of wrist support.
M-Dash was still on the bumpered lane beside our alley. His four games topped out with a high of 87. My first game was a 126. Then I stopped caring because, well, we had bowled the week before, and to my sensibility, four games of bowling in 1 year is a fine total. Anna? Possessed. Again. She changed balls three times in the first game before going back to the rack for her original choice. With that special glove of hers, her concentration on her stride and on her release point, and constantly drying her palm with a little fan above the ball return, the woman flirted with 200 all night, finally topping out at 201. She was in such a good mood, she took swigs from my beer. And Steve Wong, with those three fingers of his slotted into the precision-fitted holes in that shiny orb, he put on a show of shows. His years of experience appeared in the grace of his footwork, the arc of his swing, the release of his ball hand sweeping upward to the projected computer scoreboard. He had the balance of a dancer, his cantilevered foot splayed behind his left shoe, his right toe tapping the hardwood in a triple X kiss of brown and yellow. He never bowled less than 270 that night, finishing with a score of 300. That's right. The computer flashed, "Perfect game, perfect game, perfect game," as the manager rang an old ship's bell behind the desk. Other patrons, who take bowling seriously, came around and shook Steve's hand and slapped his back and paid for every rolling rock I ordered, proving that, yes, indeed, his were magic shoes. We played again a couple of days later, at M-Dash's demand. He'd been dreaming about the game.
"Sleeping, I can see the black ball curving to the one pin to knock down all of them. But they don't smash like I want. I want to smash them all down."
Breaking 100 was now a vision quest for him. On what would be only his third trip to the lanes, he eschewed the kiddie bumpers and promptly rolled five gutter balls in a row. "Welcome to the varsity squad," I told him, before missing the 9 and 10 pins by a foot. "Score me an open frame 8. Anna picked up a spare by nicking the 7 pin, so was already beating me. Last up, Steve Wong rolled a strike. A flash flood begins with a drop of rain on stone. A forest fire tells with just a whiff of distant smoke. A perfect game of bowling is a possibility only when an X is recorded in the little box in the corner of frame number 1, the first of 12 in a row. Steve Wong racked up 9 straight strikes. So in the 10th and final frame of our first game that night, M-Dash posted a 33, and I had a 118, Anna a 147. A gang had gathered around our lane, about 30 people. By frame 6, the other games had quit to watch what might be Steve Wong's second perfect game in a row, an oddity in marvel as rare as twin rainbows. He opened the 10th with a strike. The crowd crowed, and Anna screamed out, "Atta, baby!" A hush fell. Steve strolled and swiped, and all 10 pins fell again. His 11th strike of the game, with one more needed for perfection redux. It would be a bad joke to say you could hear a pin drop, but you could. Dead silence met Steve's final roll. When "perfect game, perfect game, perfect game" honked on the computer scoreboard, you'd have thought it was New Year's Eve on the same night the Brooklyn Bridge opened, Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, and Saddam Hussein was dragged from his spider hole. Wong mania was in full force, and we didn't get out of the place until exactly 3 in the morning. 3:00. Get it? Had we bothered with a second game that night, you might not be reading this. Steve could have bowled a 220 and then played pinball. But fate is a kooky dame. 4 nights later, bowling for free as a prize for his 24 consecutive tens at one blow, we returned for a goofy night of watching M-Dash try for something other than an open gutter 33. But Steve Wong altered the tenor of the evening
by rolling Chinese lightning for a strike. He then rolled another. And well, holy cow, as they say at bowling alleys on the subcontinent of India. Steve rolled strike after strike, talked less and less, and entered a concentration zone that blocked out the rest of existence. He said nothing, never sat down, and never looked at what was happening behind him. People were texting their bowl mates to get down to the lanes on the PDQ. Free pizza was delivered. Smartphone cameras came out in force. And a family of six showed up, the little kids in their pajamas, pulled out of bed because a sitter could not be found, and Mom and Dad did not want to miss another perfect game. Steve Wong had yet to bowl anything other than a big black X for his third game in a row. In an atmosphere of utter wonder and magic, he kept right on smacking down 30-point frames for his fourth, fifth, and, wait for it, sixth game in a row. We were open-mouthed and hoarse from screaming, the three of us, huddled around the little desk between lanes 7 and 8, surrounded by a crowd of 140 and then some. I had stopped bowling. Anna began pacing instead of playing in the fifth frame of game 2, not wanting to somehow mar the alley and screw up Steve's run. Only M-Dash kept rolling, 2 gutter balls to everyone that found the stack. Huzzas rose and fell from lofty levels to silences thick with stilled lungs. Anna's atta-baby became the common cheer, not just for each of Steve's strikes, but charitably for M-Dash's knockdowns as well. When the 72nd consecutive strike for S. Wong was computed as his 6th perfect game in a row, the man in full stood at the foul line, rubbing his eyes, his back to the berserk crowd which screamed and stamped and pounded bottles of beer and cups of soda. None of us had ever been present for that kind of achievement. Trivial to some, as what is bowling but a game, but come on! 6 perfect anythings are a permanent memory. Check out the internet for videos of the evening, and you'll see Steve stone-faced as strangers and pals celebrate him like a congressman-elect. Look at the comments. About 90% of the anonymous horde call it a hoax. But never mind them. The next day, Steve was fielding calls from media outlets that wanted comments, photos, and appearances on camera. He went on the local news, the 4 channels shooting him individually on lane 7 as he stood, stiffly, the embodiment of on-camera discomfort. You actually roll all those perfect games? How's that feel, rolling all those perfect games? What were you thinking? You ever think you'd roll so many strikes? Yes. Good. Trying to get another. Nope. Each camera crew asked him to finish the interview with a roll down the alley. He obliged, with 4 strikes, on camera, on cue. The string continued. The capper was a call from ESPN for an appearance on a show called Alley Nation. They'd pay him $1,700 for just showing up. And if he rolled another perfect game, he'd get one of those 6-foot-tall checks for $100,000. You'd think such a heady few days would be fun, with an invite to be on TV and all. But Steve comes from a long line of quiet, humble Wongs. He clammed up. M-Dash saw him at work at Home Depot, standing stock still in power tools, supposedly racking saber saw blades. But all he was doing was staring at 2 different blades in their clamshell packaging, like the labels were written in a foreign language. He woke up at night with the dry heaves. When we picked him up in my VW bus to drive to the ESPN gig, he almost forgot the bags with his monogrammed shoes and Chinese lightning. The show was going to be at Crown Lanes in Fountain Valley, a long drive, so we stopped at an In-N-Out Burger before hitting the freeway. In the drive-through lane, Steve finally confessed what had been bothering him. He did not want to bowl on TV. "You against the idea of getting free money?" I asked him. "The closest I've ever been to 100K was a Powerball ticket with 2 numbers right." "Bowling should be fun," Steve said. Laughs in an informal social contract. We roll when our turn comes up, and no one cares about the score. M-Dash wanted him to take his winnings in silver dollars. Steve continued as we crawled through the line. In and out is all.